Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know we're
gonna... Yes, indeed, we started to burn many things we found. The wonderful, fabulous, beautiful, and tremendously talented Dar Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns and the Rivertown Kids on their Grammy Award-winning album, Tomorrow's Children. That's what it's called, Tomorrow's Children, a beautiful title for an amazing album. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're back with another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We got a great show for you. We'll start off with Myra Reason from Southern California. Kind of fill us in on all the latest disasters at San Onofre, the San Onofre nuclear plant. I have an article running around the internet today, posted at many places, including commondreams.org and freepress.org. It was originally published actually at the Progressive magazine website, progressive.com, I think it is, and I put it up to the website I edit, www.nukefree.org. All these various postings on the same article about the restart duel at San Onofre. The working title at Common Dreams and Free Press is San Onofre 2, Boxer, Markey, and the public drop dead because the owners, operators, manipulators, thieves, murderers, villains behind the San Onofre nuclear plant are essentially telling the public and the Congress to take a hike. They want this thing relicensed. They want to open Unit 2 at San Onofre on a 70% experimental basis as soon as they possibly can. Continue to bilk the public for hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that could, should, and would be going to renewable energy otherwise. After we discuss this with Myla and talk about what's happening in San Onofre, we'll take your calls, by the way, at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888, a really easy number to remember and even easier to dial. We're going to talk with Clint Wilder, author of Clean Tech Planet, a new book out about converting our nation and our world to renewables and to other forms of technologies that will actually allow us to survive on this planet. What a concept, even though the big corporations are not going to make the same kind of money on it. So I'm looking forward to that. Clint and I are also going to do a little war storytelling about, or peace storytelling about, some great concerts that we went to together, that we were both at simultaneously, the No Nukes concerts in 1979, and then the most recent No Nukes concerts in sunny California a couple years ago with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and Graham Nash. We are on now with Myla Reason. Myla, are you there?
I am.
Okay, so I've got this piece out, which you helped me correct, about what's happening at San Onofre. And why don't you give us, I'll let you start off, give us a little fill-in. You're in Southern California. How far are you from this San Onofre nuclear plant?
Well, I'm about 60 miles north, but I certainly consider that to be part of the San Onofre nuclear danger zone. You know that after Fukushima, the radiation traveled all the way across the Pacific Ocean to North America, so it's not as if, you know, 60 miles is very far at all.
Sadly, I do know that. My grandson was born sometime after Fukushima in L.A., and the one time I broke down on the radio was talking about all this radiation from Fukushima coming all the way across the Pacific into the danger zone where you live. About 8 million people, 50 miles from San Onofre, a totally worthless, useless, dangerous piece of junk, radioactive to boot. But tell us, Myla, what are the latest developments? You read and helped me edit my article currently posted around the Internet called San Onofre 2, Boxer Markey and the public drop dead, Boxer being Senator Barbara Boxer from California, Markey being Representative Ed Markey from Massachusetts, hopefully next senator from Massachusetts, and of course the public is you. So tell us about what's going on there, Myla.
Well, you know, Harvey, it's just absolutely terrifying to those of us who are paying attention. It looks like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has sent very clear signals that they more likely than not are going to give permission to Edison to restart their badly damaged nuclear reactors by June 1st.
And, God, that's hard to believe. Both of them?
No, it's terrifying.
Both of them or just Unit 2?
Pardon me?
Are they going to want to open both of them or just Unit 2?
Oh, no, no, just Unit 2, but that's bad enough.
Yep. And so tell
that's
us...
That's bad enough. You know, I think that part of what's so terrifying is that we see that, you know, that they'll just ignore Senator Boxer, ignore Congressman Markey, and just do as they please, and just continue mumbling their mantra that they're following their procedure, when in fact they have signaled that they will allow a very, very damaged nuclear reactor to be restarted in an area that's riddled with earthquake faults in a tsunami zone. So, you know, it may be that they can run it safely for a little while, but there's also a potential to wipe us all out.
Yeah, don't even go there. They can't run any nuclear plants safely. Now, those of you who are interested...
Well, you know, what I mean is, you know, relative to blowing us all up tomorrow.
Right. Well, they're more than capable of doing that, especially since they've got insurance limits that, you know, protect them from any liability in a major
disaster.
Well,
you know, I mean, worst case scenario, nothing's going to protect them from the radiation and from the, you know, it's a suicidal, crazy, insane scenario. It's mind-boggling. It's hard to figure out what's going through their heads.
Nothing. Well, money, that's what's going through their heads.
Right.
So, if you are interested, they have a wonderful website called EcoWatch, run by my friend Stephanie Spear, also published the article, and with that they ran a really beautiful, well, a very accurate, shall we say, aerial photograph of San Onofre. When you look at this thing, Myra, it's on an artificial bluff. I mean, if there was an earthquake, God forbid, that thing would just plop right into the ocean. I mean, it's right there.
Right. It's right on the water's edge. And you know, it even if we manage to shut it down, we've got 40 years of high-level waste sitting on the water's edge, this radioactive trash.
That's 40 years of generating it. I mean, it's going to be radioactive for 4 billion, basically.
It forever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Now, for those of you who haven't been following it, we did have an incident at Fukushima. A rat, a rodent, ate through the cable insulation on a cable that was feeding electricity into the cooling system for one of the spent fuel pools there, and shorted the thing out, which over time, 4 days or less, could have caused a apocalyptic release of radiation by exposing these spent fuel rods to the air. They would ignite spontaneously, at least the zirconium alloy would ignite, and pour more radiation into the atmosphere than anybody even wants to think about. And so then they finally got on top of that, and they were installing rat protection, not to protect the rats, but cable protection from the rats, wiring or whatever, and they managed to short the thing out again while they were putting the protection on. this is the Keystone Cops of the atomic energy reality here, and God knows what they could do at San Onofre. So what is what signals has the Nuclear Regulatory Commission given my reason that lead you to believe that they're going to license this thing?
Well, you know, they had a meeting with Edison last week. I think it was last week. I think it was on the 3rd.
Now, if it was Thomas Edison, they'd be having a seance, but this was a Southern California Edison, so go ahead, yeah.
Regulatory dodge. They're playing games with paperwork, and they figured out a way to try to get around all of the regulatory hurdles to slow down the research.
Amaro, are you breaking up on us?
Am I?
You were on me, but go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, it's a regulatory dodge, as you put it in your article. They basically figured out a loophole to hasten the process because they're desperate to restart their damaged nuclear reactor. So they submitted a license amendment, but they asked for a determination that there was no significant harm. If you can believe it, they're actually claiming that there's no significant harm to run this damaged nuclear reactor in a tsunami zone on a fault line at 70% power and see what happens. And the NRC said, sounds good to us. And we're going to give you this determination that there is no significant harm to run it at 70%. And what that does is it cuts out the opportunity for the public to have an adjudicatory evidentiary hearing prior to making the determination about whether or not they can restart their damaged nuclear reactor.
So they don't want to. They don't want to have a public hearing where anybody has to testify under oath.
Correct. They've been having lots of public meetings, and they're insufficient because they lie all the time, and they can't really be held accountable for those lies. We want an opportunity to have our experts ask questions of their experts under oath, and that is what we should. You know, if they really were following their process, they would have allowed that a long time ago. Instead, they're giving us these very insufficient public meetings that are just sort of dog and pony shows where they get up and lie.
Uh-huh. And now, Barbara Boxer and Senator Barbara Boxer and Representative Ed Markey have written a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they're asking that the NRC not relicense, not allow these plants, certainly not Unit 2, to go back online until there is such a hearing. And yet, at the time that they were asked and the NRC to respond, the NRC staff went ahead and did this no significant hazard nonsense. Is that correct?
That is correct. They issued a. They said that they were that they think that there is no significant hazard, and the public has 30 days to respond to that. But it's, you know, it's looking pretty dire. And let me just say that, you know, the state has some authority here, too.
How? How does the state have authority? Because usually with nuclear power, the state is completely shut out because of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. So
right.
What gives the state of California any leverage here?
Lots of jurisdictional games going on. You know, they carve the jurisdictions up. So the state can't say a word about the safety of the plant. They can't say anything about the, you know, whether or not the design changes. You know, they can't deal with that. But the state does have jurisdiction over all of this water that's being used to cool the plant. There are federal laws in place that give the state's jurisdiction over the coastal waters. And the plant, when it's operational, and even when, you know, even they still have to cool these reactors, whether or not they're online, because they're hot. You know, they're thermally hot, and all of the this high-level radioactive waste that's sitting crammed into these overcrowded cooling ponds also need water to be circulated. So they're sucking in 830,000 gallons of seawater every minute.
Oh, my God.
It's an enormous amount of water, and the state has jurisdiction over this process. There are newer technologies that would not be quite as devastating on marine life.
So right, but they'd be expensive to... They'd be expensive to install, right?
Pardon me? That's the thing. The power plant is claiming, you know, that they need more time. They've had years, but they want years more. And the state, if the state were to actually require them to follow the law and to put in place this newer technology, they might say, you know, it's not worth it.
Right. But so the state's not holding them up to the standard that they should be held up to. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. The state's giving them a pass. They've been giving them a pass for quite a long time now. And so that is a way that the state could impact this. You know, the state could actually pull the light of
their... you're breaking up again, Myla. You got to... Myla, there's something with your phone.
Yeah.
Okay, now you're back again. All right, so Jerry Brown, the governor, could intervene here, and we're running into this at Indian Point in New York State also, where there are water issues involved that Governor Cuomo could use to go in and shut down the Indian Point reactors, but so far we haven't seen that either.
Right, and then we also have a Public Utility Commission that is a lapdog to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I mean, to Edison, the head of our Public Utility Commission, our California Public Utility Commission, is a former high-ranking executive of Edison. Edison is the owner and operator of majority owner. And operator of San Onofre. So you've got people who were appointed by the governor of California, who are looking out for this private interest. They're looking out for San Onofre, and they're not looking out for the people of the state of California. Governor Brown could do a whole lot. He could actually shut down San Onofre by virtue of his authority over the California Public Utility Commission and the Water Control Board, and he has been absolutely silent. He hasn't said a word. He hasn't issued a statement, and he hasn't signaled that he's going to do anything about this. And so it's, you know, I despair.
Well, don't despair. Here's what we got to do. We got to write. Now, it's quite astounding. And by the way, Clint Wilder, you're on the phone with us? Clint Wilder, are you there? Okay. I thought he was on the phone, but not. So my reason, we could, first of all, it's quite astounding that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would blow off Senator Boxer and Representative Markey. Senator Boxer is the chair of the committee in the Senate that oversees the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so we should be encouraging Senator Boxer to continue to put pressure on the NRC to at least have these hearings before the plant opens, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that could be pretty effective. And then we can also pressure Governor Brown to move ahead with these water issues. Now, the water issue did come up at Oyster Creek in New Jersey, and they have been told that they have to put in cooling towers. And the deal they cut was that they would shut the plant within 7 years rather than installing these cooling towers. And I assume the cooling towers could be forced upon the owners of San Onofre as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's exactly what the state can do. They can require them to build these cooling towers rather than sucking in all of that water from the ocean and creating this massive marine life die-off.
Yeah, of course, they probably have to stick them. Given where the plant is situated, they probably have to stick the cooling towers smack in the middle of I-5 there. I mean, I don't know where else they'd put them. You know,
right.
So, Myla, we don't, on the show, we don't despair. There is plenty of, reason for hope here. Quint Wilder, are you on with us yet?
I believe so.
Oh, you are. Hey, Quint. Now, you're a Californian also, right?
Yeah, Northern, right.
You're in Northern California. So, yeah. We're talking about your state budget here at the two reactors in Southern California, that are, well, of course, Unit 1 at San Onofre, thankfully, shut in the 1990s, and now we have these two lunatic reactors that are thankfully shut since last January. And, this is your book, Clint, is, Clean Green Technology here, or Clean Tech America. Is that that's your title, right?
Clean Tech Nation.
Clean Tech Nation.
How the U.S. can lead in the new global economy.
Okay, so, of course, Myla Reason and I are here to say that one way to lead in the new global economy is to shut these ridiculous nuclear plants down, and especially to keep the ones that are shut, permanently shut. And so, Myla, I'm going to continue to be optimistic here. You and I have met. We've spoken together at at least a couple of events, and you beautifully ran a discussion group on the phone for a few weeks. I think that the citizens' movement in Southern California that shut San Onofre is very powerful. And there are a lot of economic reasons as well as health and safety ones for keeping these reactors shut. So we're going to segue in here to Clint. Myla, do you have anything else to tell our listeners about this campaign to keep San Onofre shut?
Well, I just love everybody to get involved and to contact Jerry Brunson. I don't have
my head. Myla, you're breaking up again.
Okay. Call Jerry Brown.
The governor.
Call Barbara Boxer.
Okay.
Call Edward Markey.
And call the Public Utilities Commission, although Michael Peavy needs to be removed by the governor.
And but, get involved.
Myla,
you know, one more thing, Harvey.
Please.
One more thing. People can go to the website sanonofresafety.org. where there is just an enormous amount of information, and that would be really helpful. They can get involved that way.
Well, that's wonderful. And Myla, you're doing a great job. This word despair does not appear in our vocabulary. I mean, I remember, I spent 3 nights in the San Luis Obispo County Jail, which I highly recommend, by the way. And, they wrote us off, and they said we weren't having any impact. And the next thing you know, they discovered that they had put the pressure vessel in backwards. And, it was a huge deal. So I am very optimistic about keeping San Onofre shut. We just got to keep the pressure on. And thank you. Thank you for your great work that you do, okay?
Thanks, Harvey.
All right, we'll be in touch.
Okay, bye.
All right, now, Clint Wilder, you're with us now from Northern California, right?
Yeah.
How northern are you?
The Bay Area.
The Bay Area.
Just outside San Francisco, yeah.
The lush liberal Bay Area of San Francisco. And what town are you in?
I'm in Sausalito.
Oh, you're in Sausalito. Are you on a boat?
No. Everyone always asks that, but we have boats, but I am not on them.
And is there a cloud of marijuana smoke hanging over Sausalito?
Lately that could be anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Washington State, Colorado.
It's got to be medicinal still in California, although that's going to disappear pretty quick, I think. I mean, I read an interesting article about how they're proceeding to write the regulations for legalized pot in Colorado. It's very interesting. They're saying you can only buy an ounce, but, given the stuff today, an ounce is plenty. And they're dealing with, selling it. I guess it's going to be legal over the counter as of January 1st, I think, coming up. It still has to be medicinal in California, is my understanding.
Another form of being green, I suppose.
Yes. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your book, Clean Tech America, and Clean Tech Nation, rather, and the content of that, you and I have shared some experiences in the world of nuclear power or anti-nuclear power, no nukes,
yes,
and rock and roll. You and I are among the few who were at two concerts, 30 years apart? 1979.
Well, yeah. Now, even though the one 2 years ago, I was not able to attend. I was out of town, even though I wrote about it beforehand.
Oh.
But unfortunately, I wasn't there. I know a lot of people who were, but I was there 1979, Madison Square Garden.
All right. Which nights were you there? Now, these are the five concerts that we did in 1979 in Madison Square Garden. They were called No Nukes. They featured Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, CSN, Paul Simon, Carly Simon, James Taylor.
Don't forget John Hall.
John Hall. So many great artists. Peter Tosh. So what nights were you there?
One night, I believe it was Sunday, which was that the last
that
one?
That was the last one. That was with Crosby, Stills, Nash.
I think I went to the big rally.
The big rally was on Sunday.
What at that time was Battery Park Landfill.
Correct.
I remember Helen Caldicott speaking, and just blew me away.
Yeah.
And then went to, and actually, at the time, a female friend of mine knew a security guard at Madison Square Garden, so I actually got to be like right up in front of the speakers. He even gave us cotton for our ears because it was really loud. And so the whole experience just totally inspired me.
Excellent.
And I joined a group we had in New York called the Shad Alliance.
Yeah, I remember the Shad Alliance.
Yeah.
Are they still going?
Stood for Sound and Hudson Against Development. But I think they wanted a seafood, you know.
All the alliances back then. The first big alliance against nuclear power, which was at Seabrook, New Hampshire, was called the Clamshell Alliance.
Clamshell. Well, I had read and heard a lot about them.
Right, and I was involved. They formed in July and August of 1976, and I came back. I was actually traveling around the world with my friend. I'd been gone for 18 months, and I came back on July 31st into Boston and went to my cousin's wedding. And on August 1st, 1976, I went up to Seabrook and just got there as the people were being dragged away from the site. That was the first. There were 18 people from New Hampshire. That was the first civil disobedience there at the Seabrook site, and then it jumped up to 180 on August 22nd, and then the following year on April 30th, we had about 2,000 people. 1,414 were arrested at Seabrook. Now, were you arrested at Seabrook?
No, I never went up to see. Well, I did visit Seabrook later on, but that's in another phase of my career. What I did do civil disobedience-wise was, so the Shad Alliance was working on this big action in the fall of 79 to shut down the New York Stock Exchange for a day.
Ooh.
Yeah. And now we didn't actually succeed in doing that, but we did force people who worked at the Stock Exchange to spend their Sunday night sleeping on their floors in their offices. So they would, you know, so they wouldn't be barred from getting there in Monday morning, which is because we were all out in force first thing Monday morning.
Well, what was the date on this? What year?
79.
And this was because of all the investments. What's that?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. You know, follow the money, right?
Right. All because of all the investments in nuclear power.
Exactly.
And this was the precursor to the Occupy movement.
Kinda.
Well,
yeah,
it was. My buddy Rennie Cushing, it was his idea, I think, to go down to Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
And he's now a state rep and has been for some time in New Hampshire.
Yeah, so people were, you know, bussing in from certainly all over the Northeast, if not beyond, to participate in this. And a lot of people got arrested and, you know, front page of the New York papers. And it was a pretty cool thing to be part of.
Good. Now, were you arrested?
No, I chose to be a support person.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I didn't go the full.
I didn't get arrested at Seabrook until 1989.
In retrospect, I've never had the pleasure of spending a night in jail, and I kind of feel like I missed out, but that's all right.
Well, there's always time. There's plenty of time yet.
True.
And you know, we'll be down at San Onofre, I'm sure, at some point, and at Diablo Canyon again, and we will be doing what we got to do to keep these reactors down. So
now, I did have one interesting. I mean, and then I sort of didn't have much to do with the energy field at all for the next 23 years. except for one little touchstone of in the nuclear power industry. So I've been a journalist my whole career, I started as a sports writer. I was actually doing sports writing while I was volunteering to shut down Wall Street. But I later moved to Boston and ended up being a local reporter for the Salem, Massachusetts newspaper.
The Salem, Massachusetts witch burner, I think.
Well, it was called the Salem Evening News, but there was a witch in the logo.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Salem makes a lot of tourist money off the witch thing.
Right. Well, there is that annual execution of 19 people that really draws a lot of
people.
So,
although these days in Massachusetts, they might be executing Republicans.
If they could find any. So you continued your activism with nuclear stuff, and
so you did
not make it to the second No Nukes concert there in Sunnyvale.
No, but what I wanted to, so while I was in, as a local news reporter in Salem, I covered a city called Peabody, and they were part of a consortium of towns in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Municipal Wholesale Electric Cooperative or something like that, or MWEC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And which had a pretty significant piece of investment in Seabrook.
Right.
And so this was a big issue locally. So it was a consortium of municipally owned utilities, of which Peabody was one of them. So the Municipal Light Commission was an elected board. And that was a big controversy on where the commission stood on Seabrook trying to divest or not. And long story short, I did get to take an insider's tour of Seabrook when I was, you know, covering that topic. And I remember thinking, could they have picked a worse place to build a nuclear power plant?
Yeah, San Onofre.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, probably. I mean, and Diablo Canyon was no bargain either.
No, but at least Diablo Canyon is, you know, a couple feet away from the beach. San Onofre is right the hell on it.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, at least Seabrook is behind the salt marsh as opposed to right on the ocean.
Yeah, which meant they had to build tunnels under the salt marsh, you know, at huge expense.
Oh, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, I was astounded they could do it at all. I'm not even convinced they did it. I think they're just lying about it. You know, they say, oh, we got these tunnels under here, but they don't really. We're talking with Clint Wilder, author of Clean Tech Nation, and a veteran of nuclear activism for how many years now?
Well, I can claim, so however many years ago 1979 was, I haven't been greatly active in that way, but since 2002 I've been writing about what I think is a much, much better form of energy.
Well, let's talk about that. What is what's the theme of your book, Clean Tech Nation? What are you trying to tell us here?
Okay, so the theme of Clean Tech Nation is that even regardless of where you are on the environmentalist spectrum, we think this issue, developing much more clean energy in the U.S., makes sense from an economic perspective and is really critical for our global position as an economic leader. These are the industries of the future. We think the fossil fuel and nuclear industries are the industries of the past. And the countries that are innovating and deploying the most clean energy technologies are going to come out ahead. And we're seeing this play out already with Germany, with China, with South Korea, with the United Kingdom, Brazil, all over the world. There's much more of a priority placed on moving in this direction. China, Japan, certainly. China's an interesting conundrum because they're doing a lot of clean energy and a lot of dirty energy. But
well,
nonetheless,
we're going to take a short break here, Clint. Author of Clean Tech Nation. We will be back after we hear a little bit about Clean Tech from Pete Seeger. And this is from Dana Lyons. And stay with us here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks, Clint. Yes, indeed. It's time for a better plan. That's the wonderful Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame, singing the Solartopia Rocky Top song. I'm on with Clint Wilder, author of Clean Tech Nation. We've shared some old war stories here about the anti-nuclear movement. And now, Clint, you have written a book aimed at outlining what the United States can do, essentially to get to Solartopia, to a cleaner, safer, cheaper, and more reliable industrial system. So tell us about the basics here of Clean Tech Nation. What's this all about?
So, as I was saying before the break, we think that my co-author and I, Ron Pernick, we think that clean tech is the industries of clean tech are really the critical industries for economic and innovation leadership.
All right. So, what are the clean tech industries? I'm going to guess that that would include wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, all that great stuff for clean energy.
Exactly.
Am I right?
And yes, clean energy. We identify four major pieces of clean tech, which is clean energy, clean transportation, clean materials, so like bioplastics and green building materials, that kind of thing, and also clean water technologies. And all four of those, though, are energy is a key component. When we talk about electric vehicles, for example, it's energy technology. You have to power that vehicle with something. And, of course, powering with electricity, even coal-fired electricity, is still cleaner than pouring gasoline into a tank.
Wow. Okay, so we cover a lot on energy here on this show, based on my book Solartopia, Our Green Powered Earth, and other guests that I've had on. Next week, in fact, I'll be having Paul Geip talk again about converting California and the world to renewables. What do you want to tell us about these other categories here of clean technologies?
Well, I mean, they're all important. Let's take piece of this, very important to mention, energy efficiency.
Uh-huh.
In all forms. This is a critical component of clean tech that thankfully is getting much more attention than it used to.
Well, it's so cheap, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, the cheapest and cleanest kilowatt is the one you never have to generate in the first place.
Right, the megawatt is envisioned by Amory Lovins,
exactly.
Who also came up with the greatest term, I think, for global warming, which he calls global weirding.
I have quoted that many times.
Yes, and people ascribe it to Tom Friedman, but in fact it was Amory Lovins.
Right.
So go ahead now. Tell us about these other clean techs in addition to the energy stuff.
Yeah, so energy efficiency, whether it's a more efficient power grid, whether it's a car that uses less fossil fuel, so thus a hybrid car, it still uses gasoline, just a lot less of it. So that's clean tech as well. Green buildings, which use less energy, both in terms of operating the building and the embedded energy, as it's known, in the materials to build the building.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Now, I had a guest on a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about using hemp to build buildings. Is that what you're talking about too?
Sure. I mean, that's one way to do it.
That way, if the building, for God forbid, burns down, everybody at least gets stoned. Sorry. Okay, go ahead. So tell
now,
us about this.
But, really, I mean, what we look at, and I should mention my day job is I'm senior editor at Clean Edge, cleanedge.com, which is a research and advisory
Clean Edge, firm. Clean Edge, to make a terrible joke, Clean Edge is what you get when the guitarist for U2 takes a shower. Okay, you didn't hear that. Go ahead.
Actually, in 11 years I've been with this company, I hadn't thought of that one. So
there you go.
Point for originality.
You had to be on a show with a really warped host here. That one. So go ahead. Tell us about clean building materials.
For example, cement is one of the most greenhouse gas intensive materials on Earth in terms of what it takes to make it. So they can actually use a waste product from coal plants called fly ash.
Yeah, I heard of fly ash.
Yeah, which is, so that's, I mean, you can, by using what's essentially the waste product of a very dirty process, you can actually reduce the carbon of a different dirty process, so the making of cement. So, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, innovations and just better, smarter ways of doing things. So,
well, let's hear about some more. Now, you know, hay straw bale houses, for example, and also using hemp for insulation. Is that stuff real? I mean, are we talking serious?
Well,
technologies?
It's real, but I don't know that's, you know, at Clean Edge we look at, you know, large scale industrial processes and the building of skyscrapers and, you know, big stuff. The straw bale, the hemp, I don't think can be, extrapolated to applications like that, but you can replace most of the windows in the Empire State Building with much more, much better windows, as they have done, and reduce the energy consumption of the Empire State Building in New York City by 40%.
Really? That's impressive.
And that's exactly. There are lots of
running
projects like that.
Running around in the basement to power the elevators? Or no, go ahead. So what other building materials, clean building materials, are there?
They're experimenting with a lot of different types of materials. I'm not completely familiar with all of them. But in terms of buildings, I mean, you're really looking the big initial payoffs are better insulation and just better control over what you're heating and cooling at what times of day. I mean, there's so much waste with, you know, air conditioning places of buildings where nobody is, and there are lots of companies that do that. There's a company in Boston called EnerNOC, N-O-C, which stands for Network Operations Center, and they can analyze the entire building's heating and ventilation and air conditioning and make it much, much more efficient.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, literally and figuratively. So what else qualifies as clean tech? What else do you talk about in your book?
In the book, some of the other things are waste to resource, where we've got, I don't know if you've ever had this really good beer in Vermont called Magic Hat.
No.
So
what's the deal with Magic Hat?
So they use they get energy from some of the waste streams, the agricultural waste streams involved in beer making, to convert that back into energy.
Uh-huh. That's good.
Yeah. There's this whole focus on a much smarter grid than we have.
How about getting rid of the grid altogether? I mean, why not make every home energy self-sufficient?
Well, I think it's not an either-or. I think the grid will be with us for quite a while, but that's not to say, I mean, you know, a completely solar-powered home that doesn't need the grid is the ideal, really. But I think, you know, when you look at, let's take solar power in general, which has been, you know, this phenomenal growth story the last few years as prices have come down, which has been a bad thing for if you happen to be Solyndra. But I hate to even say the word, but there it is. It's really, you know, it's been a boon for installers. If you're installing or buying solar panels, not only are the panels cheaper than they've ever been, But as a homeowner, you can lease the system on your house from companies like SolarCity with no money down.
How do you do that?
Because basically the SolarCity finances it like a mortgage, or I almost like the analogy of when you buy a car. You know, very few people go in and have to, you know, plunk down 20, 30 grand. You finance it.
Well, my my daughter and son-in-law have a house in Southern California, and they put had solar panels put on their house for with no money down. And I guess the installer is going to be paid with tax credits and things like that, and of course the ongoing sale of electricity. So that's happening all over California, yeah?
All over California, all over New Jersey, Arizona, lots of places.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is part of your book, Clean Tech Nation. We're talking with Clint Wilder. Who published your book, Clint?
HarperCollins.
HarperCollins. I love that. They published my first book in 1972.
Wow.
They told me they thought it was a ridiculously worthless book, but that if Howard Zinn would write the introduction, they would publish it, and he did, and they did. So that's a mere, what is that, 41 years ago. So what else is in Clean Tech Nation that you can tell us about?
Well, one of the things that relates to, you know, a topic of your show is in our final chapter, which is called a 7-point action plan for repowering America, we lay out the five laws of clean tech. Number one is clean tech can scale. You know, a lot of people who don't know any better say, oh, this stuff's never going to amount to very much. That is absolutely not true. In fact, one of my favorite factoids that I've been quoting ever since this statistic came out. So in 2012, all we heard about was the natural gas boom, right? The shale gas, the fracking, and how, you know, this is wonderful and new energy source for America. It's domestic, it's cheap, et cetera. It's cleaner than coal, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
But statistically, in the year 2012, the United States added more new electric generating capacity from wind power than from natural gas.
Even with fracking?
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. 41% of the new capacity that came online last year was from wind power, and 33% was from gas.
And, of course, none of it was nuclear, so they haven't built a nuclear plant
for
a long time.
And that's the perfect segue to our number two law of clean tech, which is that the developed world does not need any more nuclear or coal power. No new nukes or coal plants.
Okay, what does it need?
The combination of renewables, efficiency, and natural gas. And, you know, and I know natural gas is very controversial, and, you know, we can get into that if you want, but that is a, you know, that energy mix in terms of new plants being built. We can supply our energy needs, and the efficiency part is very important to reduce demand as we're increasing supply with these new sources.
Well, does the developing world even need a grid? Now, that's the question. I mean, a lot of these countries that don't have centralized electric grids, I don't know how many there are.
That's absolutely right. I mean, so the developing world is a different story, and, you know, China, that's China's kind of its own case. But in terms of, you know, some of the smaller countries, this phenomenon called the leapfrog effect, where, you know, the best example is in telecommunications, where they didn't have centralized phone systems, landlines. They went straight to cell phones.
Right.
Well, in the same way, you could go straight to distributed energy sources like solar, small wind, small geothermal if you have the resource. And you don't have to build this, you know, very elaborate, expensive grid with centralized power stations if it's not already in place.
Well, that's a relief to hear. What else now? In addition to building materials and energy, what else are we talking about with clean tech?
Well, I mentioned clean water technologies.
No, let's hear about that. Tell us some specifics about clean water technology.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I mean, this is a huge issue out in the West and in California. Moving and filtering and, you know, getting clean water to the places that need it is a hugely energy-intensive process.
Uh-huh.
So is desalination. If that's, you know, some people say, well, we'll just, you know, we have all this water in the ocean, we'll just desalinate it and get our water that way, which it sounds great, but these big desal plants use a ton of energy, which is fine if you're Saudi Arabia and you've got all this, you know, you have no, you're a desert, you're on the ocean, and you have tons of energy, cheap.
Yeah, because, you know, the Saudis are really building a lot of solar, is my understanding.
Solar, yeah, and especially if you look at in the United Arab Emirates, the Masdar initiative in Abu Dhabi is some of the world's leading clean tech and sustainable practices going in there, which is great to see, you know, for a place that has been so dependent on oil. As I say, when you really dig into all the different aspects of clean tech, at some point you're going to see that it's usually an energy issue that makes it, you know, the clean tech alternative is the one that's using less energy or a cleaner form of energy than its conventional, traditional way.
Okay, and so what else? Now, what you got? One more. You got water. You got building materials. You got energy in general. What else is covered in your clean tech book? Clean tech America.
And clean transportation.
All right, let's talk about clean transportation since I ride a bike every day.
Yeah, well, that's the bicycle is the most productive form of transportation ever invented in terms of how far you get per unit of energy expended.
And you know who, of course, invented the bicycle?
I don't.
You don't?
I do.
You don't know who invented it? That's okay. You don't have to know. I happen to know because I looked it up.
Was it Da Vinci?
Yes, it was. You do know.
Okay, good. Good guess.
There you go. Leonardo da Vinci invented the bicycle. There's actually a bicycle in the Air and Space Museum in Washington at the Smithsonian that was built by the Wright brothers.
Uh-huh.
And they were really expensive back then. I mean, you know, no gears, none of that stuff, barely a brake even. But, you know, in terms of the current economy, the bicycles were pretty expensive.
So that's a good zero-carbon form of transportation. And obviously, you know, in encouraging bicycling is we should all be doing that. And it's encouraging to see that San Francisco's soon going to have bike sharing, which is pretty popular in European cities, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, they have it in Boston as well.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I don't know about New York City yet, but a friend of mine, Charlie Komanoff, is a major... Oh no, we're out of time. Clint Wilder, thank you so much for being on with us. Clean Tech Nation, Clint Wilder. We're going to be back next week with Paul Guyte to talk more about the transition to renewables in California. Clint, you're welcome to call in anytime you like. You're a great guest. We appreciate
it. Okay, thanks, Harvey.
HarperCollins, the book is Clean Tech Nation from Clint Wilder. We will see you next week again on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Cleaner tech than you ever imagined. Have a great week.
The apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna